As Hawaii's population ages, our need for outside help grows. State health officials have been working on a new licensing program to make it safer for our seniors when they bring workers into their homes to help them with daily activities. Keith Ridley is the chief of the State Health Care Assurance Branch. He sat down with us to talk about what's changed to help guard against unqualified home care workers.
These are for home care agencies. Home care agency licensing will begin August 10th, this Friday. And what it does is it requires any home care agency, whether existing currently or anyone considering opening a home care agency in the future, to become licensed. That way we can ensure that the public remains safe in their own home as they receive care from these home care agencies. So the takeaway is that people can be assured that the state has oversight over these agencies, and for people employed by these agencies, we will require background checks, for example, for those who are providing that care to those in their homes. The second is that if anyone in the public wants to see whether a home care agency that they're considering hiring is in fact licensed, those licensed facilities will be listed on our Department of Health website. So they'll be able to go at any time, view our website to determine which agency is licensed or not licensed. There's also information on our website that provides general information about what a home care agency is, what a home care agency is not, the kinds of services they can do and the kinds of services that they cannot. Not that they might not, but they cannot. So, for example, they cannot do financial record keeping for the agency. So you may remember that many years ago or several years ago, there were cases in the newspaper of those of individuals who were financially exploited in their own home. So this will help to prevent that sort of thing. So by rule or by statute, really, individuals working as home care workers will not be able to provide any kind of bookkeeping or record keeping or financial record keeping for their clients. What they can do, and what we want to focus on certainly, is the ability for individuals to be able to remain in their home, remain independent, and receive assistive type of care. That assistive type of care can include light home cleaning. It can include personal care. So it could be bathing, grooming, mending of clothes, dressing, toileting, showering, these sorts of things. A worker at a home care agency can also provide companion care. You could just go there and be a companion to an individual in the home. You can take the person to doctor's appointments, take them to do some marketing, and the home care agency worker can do light cleaning, as I mentioned earlier, but also cooking and preparing meals for the individual. That way that person can stay in their home. They don't have to go to another residential care home to have 24-hour care by someone. They can remain independent in their own home.
So as far as these workers then, so now they have to be certified or registered with the Department of Health.
Well, they would be employed by an agency that is licensed. And part of the employment, the agency will be required to train them, to oversee what they do and how they do it. And they'll also be required to be background checked. So there'll be a very extensive background check performed to ensure that there haven't been any issues with that individual before, either criminal or administrative. And administrative meaning no administrative findings, such as with adult protective services or that sort of thing.
Okay. And as far as then records about complaints and all of that, will the general public be able to go online to look at this, to look up this information?
As far as complaints, we do have a form online where someone can submit a complaint to us. We also have the ability, and we encourage individuals to inform us if there is any agency that they suspect may not be licensed. We want to go out and make sure that we make contact with those agencies to ensure that they understand what the law requires. So those are some things that are available. We are not yet required to post on our website inspection reports of home care agencies. We don't have a problem doing that. It's just that it's not a requirement at this point. We are providing copies of those inspection reports on other healthcare facilities that people may also be looking for, such as an adult residential care home or a skilled nursing facility or others.
Right. And you are required to post those?
Correct.
And you're doing that now?
And we're doing that now.
Okay. And then as far as a checklist, I mean, this is really like unlicensed contractors, right, in the construction business, only we're talking about home care services.
Right. You're talking about individuals coming into your home who will be able to help you with bathing and toileting and dressing and grooming and doing light cooking and or cooking and light cleaning and that sort of thing. So somebody coming into your home. So in a way, it is much like trying to ensure that the unlicensed contractor doesn't remain unlicensed, but also because this is much more personal. This is someone coming into your home to provide those very personal kinds of care services for the individual so that I can continue to remain in my home, continue to be independent, continue to have my own lifestyle, whatever that might be. So this will be the avenue for that.
Now, I've seen things advertised on Craigslist and Nextdoor where folks are saying, oh, yep, I need someone to come in and I'll, provide housing in exchange for X, Y, and Z, cooking, cleaning, what have you, and chauffeuring around town. So are we talking about the same kind of a thing?
It depends exactly what you're referring to, because there are a number of different models that could coincide with that. This home care model is where if I'm living in my own home and as I'm continuing to age and I need, in order to remain in my home, I need some help with some of the things that I described. This gives me an opportunity to find someone who is licensed, who has gone through the process of review by the state, and whose employees have been background checked to ensure that they will provide safe services to the client. Whereas other kinds of models, if I feel I need a little bit more help, I need 24-hour help, for example, even though I might be relatively independent, I can walk around and I can get around on my own, I can feed myself, etc. If I need 24-hour help, I may need to move into someone else's residence and be cared by them.
Right, and that's the care
home. That's more a care home.
Versus home care.
Versus home care, exactly.
Okay. Anything else we need to know about that, though?
Well, they're all, whether it's a care home or home care agency, they need to be licensed by the state. And the list of licensed facilities for a care home, for example, is on our website. As we process applications for a home care agency, those licensed facilities or agencies will be listed on our website as well. Now, notwithstanding the beginning of the licensing program, we know that there are a number of home care agencies that are currently in operation. They may continue to be in operation. So if you're being provided services by a home care agency, they may continue to provide those services so long as they make an application to the state to become licensed, and they are actively going through the licensing process.
Okay, it's not like you're going to come in and shut them down because they haven't done the paperwork.
That's correct.
And how many are we talking about?
We're talking, the numbers are hard to identify, but we think that there are somewhere between 150 and up, and it could be way up. So we're really not sure, and we'll get a better handle on that certainly when we see the applications starting to come in.
And then are there penalties if you don't comply?
Yes. If you don't comply, then we can go after you. We can go after the agency that remains unlicensed and for whatever reason, feels that they don't need to be licensed. We do that with our other licensed facilities and agencies. We want to make sure that everybody gets the word that there is a licensure program and you've got to go through this process. Those who don't go through the process, we have issued cease and desist orders. If necessary, we'll go to court We can also issue fines.
Now, there are a lot of agencies that are complaint-driven. Will you folks do unannounced inspections, or how does that work?
Yes, there'll be unannounced inspections as well. Notwithstanding, this is different from a care home where there is a facility to go into and conduct an inspection. These are agencies that may have an office and they send employees. They send home care workers to visit the client. So what we'll do is we can conduct unannounced visits of that office, look at paperwork to make sure that the paperwork is up to requirements, that employees who are being sent to service clients have in fact been background checked, they have been trained, they know who to call in case there is an emergency. All of those sorts of things are things that we can go in and conduct an inspection of.
And is this program being modeled after someplace else on the mainland?
There are a number of other places on the mainland that do this sort of licensing. And the modeling really is based on, from a rule standpoint, from a regulation standpoint, really comes out of statute. And the legislature felt that it was important that this aspect of care be one of the many aspects of care that become available to the public.
And because we saw the pressure to provide online inspection reports, that was done recently, and I know you folks had some staffing issues in order to comply with that, but do you foresee then the department doing this with home care companies as well?
I think it's very likely that other agencies and facilities that we are not yet required to post inspection reports, I think we can see that those will come and those will happen. If we don't have to do it, we do have other work that we need to do, so we do need to prioritize the work that we have. To the extent that we have the time and staffing available to do these extra things once we accomplish all our other priority work, then we'll be happy to do that. But at this point, we're not anticipating doing that.
Are we properly staffed just to deal with this new rule come Friday?
From the standpoint of conducting licensing process, going through the application process, yes, we have dedicated one person, or identified one person who will be dedicated to this process. And then we'll see, based on the number of applications we have, whether we need to deploy more resources to that, or whether over some period of time we're able to just absorb that entire program amongst the rest of our staff.
And as far as the unannounced inspections, do we have enough staff to deal with that?
Yes, again, it'll depend on the numbers that we ultimately have licensed. But at this point, we would have enough.
Okay, so folks have any questions, they can go to your website to get up to speed.
Correct.
All right. Anything else you think would be important to know?
Well, we know that these agencies provide a very important service to the public, and we hope that the public will take advantage of the information that we have on the Department of Health website, both in terms of general information about what home care involves, what it does not involve, and then view the listing of our licensed agencies.
That was the Department of Health's Keith Ridley talking about a new licensure program designed to protect seniors from unqualified home care workers and potential abuse. The new rules take effect August 10th, which is tomorrow. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, we'll hear more about aging in place and what goes on in home renovations to do that. But first, your quiz. This morning, we've got our binoculars fixed on the upland grasses in hopes of catching sight of the national bird of Pakistan. But why are we looking for a Pakistani bird, you ask? Well, because there is a Hawaii connection. So back to the bird. This one has a rotund body. Adults are approximately 12 to 15 inches in length. Its throat and neck are white, and the top of its head, breast, and back are gray or buff-colored. Now, Mother Nature has blessed it with a bright scarlet eyeliner and a black mask worthy of the Lone Ranger. The black feathers extend down the neck like a collar. This native of South Asia is also easily identified by its red beak and legs. From 1930 to 1941, these birds were raised alongside ducks, quail, and peafowl at the Mokapu Game Farm on Oahu's windward side. It was later introduced to all six populated islands. So for today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this creature that in Indian mythology is believed to be in love with the moon? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Dr. Gazal Moyeti, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Nathan Eagle takes a deep dive into who's funding Hawaii's Republican Party. Morning, Nathan.
Good morning.
So you've got some billionaire name-dropping today, huh?
I do, yeah. I started looking deeper into these numbers, and it came down to just a few people giving the bulk of the funding for the Hawaii Republican Party, kind of really helping turn their finances around.
So who's on the list?
Well, locally, we've got Fred and Annie Chan. They made their fortune in tech in Silicon Valley, and they moved back to Honolulu several years ago. They've together given about $50,000. We've got Edward Ruski. He's a Los Angeles real estate titan. He gave another $25,000. And then we have almost a millionaire, Jay Scheidler, who's a Honolulu investor, giving $25,000 of his own.
Now, lots of people just think, wow, that's a huge chunk of change. But I guess these folks really can afford it.
Yeah, I think so. The Chans, for instance, you know, they built this home in Silicon Valley and sold it for $100 million. At the time, it was thought to be the most expensive home sale in the country, which they sold to this other Russian billionaire who was a big Facebook investor.
And now the Chans, they bought out, didn't they buy a home out in Portlock at one time?
Yeah, the old Kaiser Estate. Which they still own. I'm not sure, though.
And so what's your take on this money and what they're trying to do?
Well, the Republican Party has been struggling for the past several years, if not longer, to really raise money that they in turn help provide, you know, training and things like that for candidates to run for office. So it's really important. It's interesting that it's only, you know, four people providing the bulk of it. But when you look at their past couple elections and they only had, you know, several thousand dollars, I think they're probably happy to get money wherever they can at this point to really try to turn things around.
Well, when we talk about money funding the party, I know the GOP really doesn't have a large pool to draw from when it comes to, you know, putting candidates up to run against the Democrats.
That's absolutely right. And they're hoping that some of these training programs and others might be able to help, but you hit the nail on the head. You know, they're only fielding in this election, I think, 23 candidates in 64 of the state legislative races, which that's not a lot.
No, it's not. So what's this about the training program?
So I don't have a whole lot of other details on that, but I think it's basically strategizing and helping them, you know, new candidates learn what it takes to run for office.
And what else are we seeing just as far as the candidates?
We're seeing them target certain races more, especially with the way some of these districts are drawn. They want to focus, you know, on races they think they can actually win. So it was that Westside's seat that Representative Tupola's giving up. That candidate, unfortunately, looks like is disqualified for not being a citizen. There's a possible pickup in Mililani, which was, if you remember, of course, was held by Representative Fukumoto, who was Republican before switching parties last year. So that district is a little split, maybe has a better chance there, and a couple others. But the more I talk to different political analysts and things like that, they're really thinking probably a net loss of the one West Side seat, and they don't see any of the others being picked up.
What about donations from, let's say, companies, local companies?
Yeah, there's a lot of those for smaller amounts, smaller compared to what the billionaires had offered. You know, we've got one that struck me was Hawaiian Electric Industries. They kicked in $2,500 to the party. We've got different other companies like A&B donating some money. They give to the Democrats as well. And then you've got the Republican National Committee actually stepping in and picking up the pace with some of its funding to the local party here for the first time, and really since the Lingle years a decade ago.
So we'll have to see how far this money goes. I mean, I think folks really want a healthy two-party system, but the Republicans are really struggling.
Absolutely. Yeah, everyone seems to agree, like, we're all better off with a two-party state.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. The primary election is just a couple days away here, and we'll see how these candidates fare and where this money goes. Thanks a lot, Nathan.
Great, thanks. Thank you.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's reality check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org. New music from an old soul. That's Oahu-born soul singer and guitarist Nick Kurosawa. There'll be nothing between you and this bright young talent in HPR's Atherton Studio on Saturday the 18th. Reserve your seats today at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Folks say that you...
With the housing crunch and an aging population, many families are looking to renovate their homes. In some cases, it's to accommodate elderly parents who want to age in place, or maybe for adult children in their families moving in with mom and dad. This trend of multi-generational housing is growing. The Building Industry Association's past president, Evan Fujimoto, sat down with us to talk about what families need to consider to take that first step.
Well, you know, because of the high cost for housing in our state, which primarily is caused by lack of supply, you know, the average price for a single family dwelling now is around $775,000 or $80,000. So it's almost impossible for most young families, new households, to be able to buy a property. And so many are opting to live in multi-generational households. I have a home where, you know, it's my wife and I and our kids and my parents that moved in with us a few years ago. They sold their home. They're in their 80s, so, you know, I have to care for them. And it works well for us because fortunately we have a property large enough where I could do an addition where they can live in that. But now about 12 to 14% of households are multi-generational. And this does not just affect, you know, your typical middle-class families. I think in the beginning, you saw a lot of these homes and households in areas like Kalihi, Waipahu, you know, your typical neighborhoods. But now, even in Kahala, you know, I was visiting my sister once, and I said, what's with all these cars on the street? She said, you know, Evan, got all these kids coming back from college, and they can't afford to, you know, move out and live on their own. So they're living with mom and dad. So even if the parents are very financially successful, you know, doctors and attorneys, the kids don't have the money for the down payment, so they just move in with mom and dad for a while.
Right, because mom and dad may not have enough, may not be flush enough with cash for a down payment on another unit.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're seeing then that as a trend.
And it has been for quite a while, and Hawaii leads the nation, I think, in the percentage of multi-generational households. California is also very strong with that. I think culturally, in Hawaii, of course, is such a stew pot of cultures here, and a lot of us come from places where families living together is quite common. So it's more socially acceptable here. You know, I think on the mainland, if you roll the clock back 10, 15 years or so, and you say, well, I'm living with my parents, I mean, you normally think of that as a millennial issue, right? But in Hawaii, it's just kind of the way it is for a lot of families. And so you're seeing more families looking at this alternative as something that's viable for them. And, you know, we're a company that I work with, Graham Builders. We do a lot of these homes, and so we work with families to come up with floor plans and, you know, arrangements that will give everybody their own private spaces. You know, people just don't want to feel like they're, you know, on top of each other. So it takes some experience to figure out how to make this all work for them. We do a lot of, for example, accessible bathrooms with very large showers, with no steps or no curbs to step over, and with enough space for, let's say, a 5-foot turning radius if you were in a wheelchair. So it's important that we know the physical needs of all the family members. And some of these households include not only grandparents, but, of course, the adult kids. And sometimes it's brother and sister and their families, you know, and their children. So, and of course, the more people you include in the household, it gets complicated because, you know, who gets what spaces and will there be adequate room on the property for parking? And all that has to be worked on.
You take into consideration, you know, wheelchair ramps. One of my neighbors across the street, they put in an elevator.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all these different considerations, mm-hmm, if you're dealing with someone who maybe is not as mobile.
The Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, pertains primarily to commercial properties. With regard to your typical single-family custom home for family, we won't apply those rules and regulations directly, although we borrow from them. And so, for example, bedroom and bathroom doors, when we design homes, they're automatically 3 feet wide. We just start with that because, you know, you never know if somebody's going to end up in a wheelchair or a walker and they just need that additional room.
But what's a door?
A typical bedroom door is actually 30 inches. So just 6 inches more is like night and day, you know. And the code says that your hallways need to be a minimum of 36 inches wide, and we'll typically make ours about 47 inches wide. I'm sorry, not 47, but about 45 inches is what it ends up with, you know, drywall to drywall. And again, just a few inches more makes all the difference in the world.
What about for elevators? Because I've seen, like, round elevators. I thought that was kind of trippy.
The pneumatic types?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So talk about that. I mean, how much space do you really need to get in and maneuver, and will a wheelchair fit in there?
Yes, they make elevators of all sizes, and I spoke with a company that was helping us to plan an elevator installation in a home in Kailua, and they're getting busier and busier because, you know, population is aging, and a lot of these homes are on slopes. So the only way for the owners to get up and down is through an elevator. Sometimes a chairlift just isn't practical for them. So an elevator will take up maybe an 8x8 space, maybe a little less than that for the pneumatic types. But these are things that have to be planned in, especially for new homes. Most people will opt for a smaller elevator. It could be a piston-driven type, but the pneumatic ones are becoming more popular. I think those were developed actually in South America and Brazil initially.
What are those costs? What do they add to the bottom line?
They're probably in the range of maybe $40,000 to $50,000, you know, if fully installed.
They're not cheap.
No, they're not. With our accessible bathrooms, the showers are larger, maybe about 5.5 to 6 feet long, maybe up to 4 feet wide. And they will be equipped with grab bars. The ideal location is usually right under the shower head, so you can hold on to that as you're taking a shower. But even if you don't install them today, if you don't like the look of them, you can at least put the solid backing in the walls and, you know, note on the plans where that is and what height it's at, so that in the future you can easily install grab bars. You know, and flooring is a very critical component in a home. And for the elderly, we have to be very careful about any kind of steps. Even when you're transitioning between one type of flooring to another, let's say you're going from a wood floor to ceramic tile or some kind of stone, typically we'll have a transition strip that, or like a little T-strip that covers that joint. But that strip normally creates a small hump in the floor at that location. Maybe it's, and it's not very high. It's maybe 3/16 of an inch. But even that can be a trip hazard for people. The elderly sometimes, you know, they wear socks in the house and they just shuffle their feet. They don't even pick their feet up off the floor. So what we have to do is mill a special piece that's level with both of the floors and then make sure that it's a seamless transition from one type of flooring to another.
So lots to think about.
A lot.
And then these multi-generational homes and units, there are requirements as far as the property size. What do people need to know if they're interested in doing this?
For multi-generational homes? Of course, the more space you have on the lot, the better. But we're able to fit things in even on smaller lots. A lot of properties are 5,000 square feet. That's a very common size in Honolulu. So what we'll typically do is have a two-car garage or carport. And if the home's going to be larger with more occupants, then more off-street parking is typically required or desired, you know, even if it's not required. Because street parking is at a premium now. So we want to make sure that we have adequate driveway space for the cars. And but we look at how we can, multiple floors, fit everybody in there. And there's certain minimum room sizes that you have to, you know, be concerned with. The bedrooms can get too small. But we can make rooms feel larger through things like either elevating the ceilings, you know, vaulted ceilings, bigger windows, things like that.
Right. So there's a way to be able to trick the eye, I guess. Huh? Mm-hmm. Anything else that you think might be useful then for folks who are considering either adding on or renovating just to accommodate either their kids coming home from college or, parents moving in?
Well, these are, you know, conversations that families need to have together with all the stakeholders. There are a lot of considerations, and sometimes it doesn't work because you don't have agreement within between family members, especially if the property is, the ownership of the property is not just the parents. Maybe there's a sister.
Like a trust or something.
Yeah, a trust involved. And that's when it gets complicated, you know, working out those kind of family financial issues. So you have to have those conversations and just lay it all on the table. But once you have agreement, then you want to make sure that you're able to finance it. And so typically that's the first step, sitting down with a lender, helping families to determine really what can they all afford if they combine their incomes, you know, what kind of mortgage payment is realistic for them. And then that will give them the budget parameters that they can then sit down with a builder, an architect, a designer to talk about actually, you know, okay, how much construction is this actually going to buy us? Will this be able to accommodate all our needs?
That was Evan Fujimoto of Graham Builders. He's a past BIA president and a certified aging-in-place specialist. He'll be featured in a seminar with AARP on Sunday at the BIA's Building and Remodeling Show that kicks off Friday at the Blaisdell Exhibition Hall.
Aloha, this is Joanne Jenkins. If you want to listen back to the show, visit the conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Earlier in the show, we hunkered down in Hawaiian grass, searching for the national bird of Pakistan. First introduced to the islands in the early 20th century, Alectoris chukar, more commonly known simply as chukar, is a partridge belonging to the pheasant family. The earliest records of its island history come from the Hawaiian Forestry and Agriculture Board logs that show that pheasants, valley quail, ice pigeons, guinea fowl, and nene were raised at the Mokapu Game Farm in Kaneohe between the years of 1935 and 36. When war broke out in 1941, the military used the game birds for food. From 1942 to 1954, Tucar were introduced to all six populated islands. When disturbed, it will run rather than fly, but if necessary, can be seen flying short distances on rounded wings. By this century, these birds were established in dry upland areas, often above tree lines. Tucar can regularly be seen at Mauna Loa, Mauna Kea, and Mount Haleakala. And congratulations to Maui resident Star Rigel. You got it right. That is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. More than a dozen countries are eyeing the ocean floor for manganese nodules and precious metals for use in the computer industry. It's still in the exploratory phase, but University of Hawaii scientists have been surveying the Pacific in advance of deep-sea mining. Craig Smith just returned from an expedition using robotics to scan the ocean floor. It brought back images of giant sea creatures and a drive to do more.
We were out with a remotely operated vehicle looking at areas on the seafloor that are supposed to be similar to areas that will be mined to determine what the biodiversity, what kinds of animals are there, what their abundance is, and what they're doing, their functions. And then ultimately we'll compare it to areas that are targeted to mining to see whether these are adequate for protecting the biodiversity of the deep sea when this mining occurs.
So where exactly did you go?
We went to, it's an area called the Clipperton Clarion Zone, the western end of the Clipperton Clarion Zone, which is about 1,200 miles southeast of Honolulu. That's where we began, and then we worked our way north in three different areas. So it's in what we call the Equatorial Pacific at depths of 4,500 to 5,500 meters.
And how large of an area did you span?
Well, we... We conducted transects across about 12 kilometers of seafloor, and then we also looked at three different areas, the total of 12 kilometers, and then we in each of these protected zones, and then we also studied seamounts. So we started working up the base of seamounts up to the summits, because one of the questions is, are the animals, the organisms that live on seamounts similar to those on the seafloor that is targeted for mining, such that if you mine a big area, there are animals on the seamounts that can then repopulate the area that's been devastated by mining.
So tell us about these crazy creatures that you folks saw.
Well, we found all kinds of really interesting animals. One of the things we found is a squid worm, which is a segmented worm, a polychaete worm that looks like a squid, and it's about 30 centimeters long, about a foot long, and it just swims around, goes down to the bottom and picks up sediments and then swims up into the water column. And these had only been seen before in the Indian Ocean at depths to about 2,000 meters. And we found one at 5,000 meters, so about 18,000 feet deep in the ocean. So this is the first record of it, and in this part of the ocean, which is really exciting. We also found a lot of other really interesting animals. We found giant sea cucumbers that are about 2.5 feet long, that actually they have appendages on the backs of their bodies that are actually sails. They stick up into the water column and the currents kind of scoot them along the bottom so they can move from one area to another to feed. We found actually about 10 different species of sea cucumbers. And then lots of other weird animals, giant protozoans. They're called xenophyophores, but they're 6 or 8 inches across. They look like fans on the bottom, and they're single-celled animals that have gotten really large in the deep sea. And they're very diverse and very poorly understood, but we think they're important to conducting processing organic matter, providing habitat for other kinds of animals, et cetera.
So it's interesting to see kind of the adaptations as you go deeper down into the ocean.
Yeah, the animals are, the environment is very different. It's very food poor, but it's also very stable. So animals have developed all kinds of interesting adaptations for acquiring food or being able to go higher up into the water column to find food that's flowing by. So we found there are lots of sponges that live on glass stalks that can be 50 centimeters high, a couple of feet, and they're just little balls that are way up in the water column. We also found a number of sponges that have never been seen before, including what we call the toilet bowl sponge. It looks sort of like a toilet bowl on the bottom of the ocean. I'm not sure why it's designed that way. Presumably to collect food in a novel way.
So this is all these are new species.
Yeah, most of the things that we observed and collected are new to science. Much more than 50%. But one of the things we did is we collected the tissues of the animals so we can do what's called DNA barcoding. We can look at their DNA and then determine how they're related to other animals collected in other parts of the ocean.
Was there anything else that you were struck by?
Yeah, we were struck by how abundant the fish were on some of the seamounts. One of the things that we were doing was putting down baited cameras, video cameras, taking video of fish as attracted to bait. And when we put the bait down on seamounts, that at some places we had over 100 eels that were attracted to one bait parcel.
Whoa.
And we've never seen anything like this, this deep down in the deep sea. And then when we put bait parcels out on the abyssal plain at the base of the seamount, we got a completely different kind of fauna, amphipods and rat-tail fish. So seamounts have a really abundant scavenging fauna, scavenging fish, and they're very different from what we found 2,000 meters below on the abyssal plain.
Now, I remember years ago when the Hurl subs would come back with their video, and the images they brought were just spectacular. And a lot of those images, you know, a lot of scientists still use because they're online, and you can sit there and compare, they found this way back when. But you're finding new stuff.
Yeah, we're finding a lot of new stuff. We are using the Hurl videos because that is a really good reference. But we're finding when we compare some of the things we found and collected, they've seen in the Hurl videos and weren't able to collect, but most of the things that we're seeing are actually different from the Hurl videos, and partly because we're working much deeper. The Hurl submersibles go to 2,000 meters, and also because this is a huge area that's really been poorly studied.
Because I remember when Alex Malahoff would come back, and they were just blown away at what they were seeing. You know, and that was decades ago, three decades ago. But if you're going deeper and also seeing, lots of really freaky stuff.
Yeah. Well, one thing to keep in mind is how huge the deep sea is. It's most of the surface of the planet, and very little of it has been studied. And we're going into an area that has not been studied at all. You know, the closest studies are, 500, 1,000 kilometers away, and we're looking at different kinds of habitats. So it's not surprising that because we're going somewhere new that we're finding new things, and also because the deep sea is very species rich but also very poorly sampled. Almost anywhere you go, you find new things. But this area where that's targeted for manganese nodule mining actually looks to be particularly diverse in some regions, in particular kinds of animals like sea cucumbers, for example.
So are they thriving off these minerals?
Well, they don't eat the minerals. Some of them use the minerals for a substrate, for a home. They attach to the manganese nodules, and that gives them an anchor so they can grow up into the water column and capture food that's passing by in the weak currents. Or others of them may live on the nodules and graze the surfaces. So they're not actually feeding on the minerals themselves, but they're using it as a substrate, a location to attach themselves or a surface to feed on.
Who's doing all this sea mining?
Well, the deep sea, we're starting doing studies of relevance to manganese nodule mining, and that hasn't started yet. It's still in the exploration phase. But there are 16 different countries that have exploration contracts in this area that we're studying. Each of these contract areas is up to 75,000 square kilometers, which is it's a big area. That's like a moderate-sized country in Europe. And they ultimately, when the mining begins, they need to mine hundreds of square kilometers every year to bring up enough material, nodules, in order to make it profitable. And they're going to mine a given area for 30 years or so. and the mining will disturb the seafloor directly by picking up the nodules and the habitat of a lot of these animals, but also it'll create a sediment plume that spreads and settles out over a much larger area.
Is there an overarching agency or entity? You know, how does that all work?
Well, there is an overarching entity, the International Seabed Authority, which is set up by the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea, and they regulate mining, mining claims, and they'll regulate mining in areas beyond national jurisdiction, so beyond the 200-mile limit of countries, territorial limit. And so they're the ones that are responsible for looking at countries make applications to have an exploration claim or ultimately to have an actual mining claim. So they're setting up the regulations. They're responsible for doing the requirement for environmental baseline surveys and also regional environmental management plans. I think they're doing a reasonably good job. But there are still a lot of gaps, and their resources are limited. So we have money, for example, funding from the Moore Foundation, the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, to go out and collect data in areas that the mining contractors are not studying and that the International Seabed Authority doesn't have the resources to study. There are a couple of big unknowns in trying to evaluate the impact of mining, and one is how many species are there and what kinds of species are there, because this whole region is so poorly studied. And the second is how broadly they're distributed. If, for example, there's a remarkable sea cucumber that's really sensitive to mining effects, but it's distributed all the way across the Pacific seafloor, then the chances of extinction are pretty small. But for most of these really unusual animals, a lot of what we found actually on this cruise is the first time they've been seen. And so we really don't know how broadly they're distributed and how likely they are to be impacted and to go extinct from a mining operation in one area of the deep sea.
Interesting. But at least you're making headway to document what you're seeing at these various depths.
Yeah, we are. We came back with a lot of data, and it'll take us a while to work it up. And then what we're going to do is put it in the framework of the other studies that have been done in other parts of the Pacific to try and understand where these species live in the ocean and whether their ranges, where most of their populations are, could be impacted by mining in one part of the ocean. But there still is an awful lot to do. This is just the first cruise. We just scratched the surface of understanding what's there and how sensitive these animals, these organisms would be to mining in one part of this huge region that stretches. I mean, the whole area that's targeted for mining, if you lay it over the continental U.S., it stretches from the west coast to the east coast of the United States. It's just a gigantic area. There may be five sites in this whole vast region have been studied. And that's like understanding the fauna of North America, what animals live there, by studying a couple places in California, maybe somewhere in Montana, maybe somewhere in Iowa, and somewhere in New England, Massachusetts, and without even studying Florida or, you know, lots of other regions. So it's really hard to understand what's going on in a huge region like this that's been so little studied.
When do these countries go in and start mining?
It's hard to know exactly when they'll mine, because the first country that starts mining will have an advantage over its competitors. So they're not going to say, oh, we're going to start mining in 5 years, 4 years, 3 years. They're just suddenly going to be doing it. It's still probably 5 to 10 years away, just because the ISA is still putting together the regulations. But I don't think we're going to have a good handle on them even 5 or 10 years from now, just because they're so vast.
Right.
One of the things that's really striking is how, even though people think of the deep sea floor as being this vast, featureless area, it actually has amazing habitat structure. We would move 500 meters to a kilometer with a remotely operated vehicle, and we find a very different system, an area without nodules, different kinds of sea cucumbers, different fish. Then we move another kilometer, and it would be different again. And so it's a very complex habitat that we really don't understand. And also another thing that's really amazing is the adaptations of these organisms and how remarkably beautiful they are. We found predaceous sponges that are feeding on animals in the water column that look like little Christmas trees with Christmas balls on them, silver Christmas trees. So just the diversity of adaptations is really remarkable.
That was Chief Scientist Craig Smith of the University of Hawaii School in Ocean and Earth Science and Technology. He was talking about the newly discovered species on the deep sea floor. You can find out more about the project on the Conversation's Facebook page.
Hi, I'm Edward Hirsch from New York City. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we can learn about some new food safety sanitation rules. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our TalkBack line. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you missed any of the show or want to find a past one, find them on the Conversation page. Look under HPR News and Talk for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of the Conversation.
This week on Says You. Back when airplanes had smoking sections, the smoking section was virtually always in the back. Why?
Because the air.
Because the air what?
Oh, for a predicate.
They're closer to the drink cart, and who's going to have a cigarette without having a drink? I mean,
It's fast, it's fun, it's some of the most colorful radio on the air, Says You.
This evening at 6:30.